making Captain Marvel. They plunged into production on Adventures of Captain Marvel right before Christmas 1940. The final product, all 216 minutes of it, cost $143,000 and was released the following March. The odds would seem to be against it. Adventures was the first live-action superhero film after all, but it was an exciting serial, and many aficionados consider it to be the best of its kind. Captain Marvel replaced the comic book's lightheartedness with real drama and cliffhanger exploits. It was also well cast, and, perhaps most admirably, it all seems relatively credible. Captain Marvel edged out Superman on the movie front by a long lead. The Man of Steel wouldn't appear on screen in a live-action serial until 1948, when the serial phenomenon was past its prime. Kirk Allen played him in the 15-chapter Superman. In the meantime, millions of adolescents were roused by the serial adventures of Batman, the Phantom, and Captain America, the only media appearance of a Marvel timely character until the 1960s, thrillingly inserted in between the Looney Tunes cartoons and the wartime newsreels. This cinematic setback didn't seem to crimp Superman's style. His likeness was licensed for innumerable puzzles, paint sets, paper dolls, real dolls, games, greeting cards, coloring books, candy, racing cars, tin ray guns, play suits, socks, shirts, and underwear. You could even have your Superman cake and eat it too, as it were. There was Superman bread, and according to media executive Ed Cato, there was, quote, Superman milk from the Horrigan Dairy Farm in Syracuse, New York, which seems a little misleading because you're not going to get superpowers from drinking that milk. Captain Marvel had his own merchandising engine as well, but impressive though it was, it didn't catch up to Superman's. Other comic strip characters, Popeye, Flash Gordon, Little Orphan Annie, were successfully marketed as licensed products, but few superheroes other than Superman and Captain Marvel were. Surprisingly, Batman's commercial potential was almost completely underexploited. Underexploited, however, is not a term that could be accurately applied to Superman's creators. In the view of Michael Chabon, piles of money, blizzards of money, were going to Harry Donenfeld and to DC Comics, but Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster had to wait a long time before either of them began to see anything resembling even a fraction of the kind of money that had been made off Superman over the years. The incredible gap between the imaginative leap that those guys had taken and the pennies that they were making off of it? Whether it's good or bad is not really a question for me. There's just something moving and sad about it. The First Generation, the Pioneers. When the comic book industry exploded at the beginning of 1939, it faced its own labor force dilemma. There were far more opportunities to pencil, ink, or write comic books than there were first-class artists to do the work. Accomplished illustrators from the comic strip or magazine world were unlikely to accept the low pay and rigorous hours of churning out comic book superheroes. A new generation stepped into the breach. Young, inexperienced, eager, and usually from a first-generation New York background. They would become their own honor roll of champions. Here are their stories in their own words. Jerry Robinson, artist.
There were a lot of publishers who were Jewish who were already in publishing. And they had brought their skills from Europe when they escaped the tyrannies in Europe. So they brought their professions with them. So they were already publishers. So they were receptive to this new genre of comic books, which apparently kids loved and bought. And they had to keep their presses going.
Carmine Infantino, artist.
You couldn't be a fine artist. You couldn't go to school for that or get the education for that. And we came from the tenements, so you had to find a way to make a living. The comic books were the only way for us.
Irwin Hasen, artist.
When people were rich, we were rich. Car, chauffeur, and we lost everything. My grandfather, it's his ring. And we started to scream and yell and scream and yell. And the depression for people who had it and lost it was terrible. So I lived through that with my parents in their apartment. We lived together, five of us. How I survived with a charming sense of humor that I have, I don't know. I could have been a drunk and I could have been a dope the way I lived with my family. So I got out of it. And I got out of it by being a cartoonist.
Carmine Infantino.
Wherever you went, there was a bunch of people sitting there waiting to be interviewed, you know. We were all hungry to be cartoonists, you know. And it was a thriving business in those days, very thriving. So you'd meet people there, and the others would come out and look at your work, and and walk away. You never hear from them again. But this went on a lot. But eventually you hooked up with somebody, you know. I went to Quality Comics, and I erased pages for a living the whole summer. Then I went to Fiction House and did backgrounds, everything to move forward. Then I worked for Charlie Biro at Boy Comics, again, backgrounds. And then they eventually put me on the main features. I did westerns there.
Jules Pfeiffer, artist.
One summer, I was hired by one of these crooks to as his assistant. And it was my job, as it turned out, to not pay these guys. When I found out that they weren't getting their checks, I warned them all. I said, don't tell them, but you're not going to get paid. And somehow I lost that job.
Carmine Infantino.
One day, Frank Giacoy and I, after making the rounds to all these many publishers, we went to D.C., and there was a guy named Eddie Eisenberg come out. I'll never forget Eddie. He says, we can't use you here. They put out Superman and Batman. He said, but go down the hall and ask for Shelley Mayer. Maybe he might be able to use you. He was on All-American Comics. And we did. We went down there, and the girl said, wait here. And she went in. She said, come on in. We went in. Now, his office, this is important, was half paneling and half glass. And you sit there, you see the artist working in the desks up in front. And he's sitting there. He's looking at our work. He was about 26 years old at that point. Quite a brain. And he's sitting there. All of a sudden, we hear the door open behind us. And somebody say, en garde. And what the hell's going on here? It's Irwin Hazen with T-square. He drops our pages, Shelley, picks up his T-square, and they start dueling all over the room, over the desk, back, forth. And finally, we've got them. I'm looking at Frank, what the hell's going on? I don't want no part of this. Shelley stabs Irwin. Irwin kisses him. It was Irwin Hazen, was the little guy that came in. He kisses him, and he leaves, and that was the end of it. And he goes back, picks up the page, and back at it again, like nothing happened. I said, Frank, let's get out of here. This is nuts.
Ramona Fraden, artist.
I would come in there at about 3 o'clock, and this bullpen happened to be right in the center of this building. There were no windows. It was pitch black except for all those lights, you know, where the artists were hunched over the tables. And around 3 o'clock, they'd all begin to sort of stir and wake up. And then the ethnic slurs would start going back and forth and the erasers would be flying. And I would slink into the back and put the drawing board up as high as I could, you know, to draw so nobody would see me because I figured they'd start teasing me or, you know.
Jules Pfeiffer.
When I reached an age of 16 and a half to get a summer job, I looked Eisner up in the phone book. He had an office down on Wall Street, of all places, and went down there and expected there to be a receptionist, but where the receptionist would usually sit, there was Eisner at a desk in a dark room drawing the spirit. And instead of brushing me off, he welcomed me in, and he sat me down, and he looked through my samples, and he told me how awful they were. And he was absolutely right, but I didn't think he had to say that. Since I was getting nowhere in talking about my work, I began to talk about his work, and he found that I knew everything there was to know about him, going back years to his earliest features. And the people he had working inside in the other room, who were professionals and who were in a very high level of work, didn't give a damn about Eisner's work. They thought of Eisner as passé. They were onto new stuff and more realistic stuff. And he was too cartoony, or he was this and that. And they didn't know anything about him and didn't care anything about him. And here he had this 16-year-old kid who had a dossier on him and just went back to Hawks of the Seas and Espionage with Black Ace and, you know, all of the things he had done earlier. So essentially he had no choice but to hire me as a groupie. he needed some support system in his own office.
Carmine Infantino.
I got a call from him in about 4 months. Come on in, we want to see you. In those days, there were 64 pages, 10 for 10 cents. But the good part for us was there were back features you could begin on, 6 pages, 12 pages, but never the lead feature. And that's what I did. I went on a thing called Johnny something or other, Thunder, I think. And then there was the Black Canary and other characters. Oh, and the Phantom Brothers, whatever the hell it was. And eventually, I move on to the old Flash.
Joe Simon, writer, artist.
As the business developed, it seems that the writers were mostly Jewish, and the artists were mostly Italian. So it turned out to be a two-race game, or whatever they call it. You know, most of these people that were doing the artwork were sons of immigrants. And these immigrants, almost everybody I knew, including Jerry Siegel, their parents were tailors. Schneiders, we used to call them, sons of Schneiders. We had a guy named Wood Ellsworth. He was the editor at DC Comics. And he was known as a company goy. That means that... untribally people. That means that they had to have a front who was not Jewish.
Irwin Hasen.
In a company corporation, you need a diversion. Don't let them look at the Jews. Let them look at Whitney Ellsworth.
Jerry Robinson.
The artists were also sons of Jewish immigrants, and they were, for the most part, at that time, barred from colleges. There was a quota system. A lot of the professions were closed to them. Here's one profession that depended on talent. They didn't care who you were or where you came from or what your name was.
Stan Lee, writer, editor.
Comic books were not respected in those days. People felt they were either read by young children or adults who weren't too brainy, who were semi-literate. And a lot of parents would even say to their children, I don't want you reading those comic books. So it wasn't a field in the beginning that I was proud to be in, you might say. And I thought someday I would be a writer and I would write books. The great American novel, like everybody wanted to write at some time or other. And I didn't want to use my name on these comics, this name that would one day appear on the great American novel. So I just shortened my name, which had been Stanley Martin Lieber, a normal name. I shortened the first name, Stanley, to Stan Lee, so that I could save my name for these great things I would later write.
Joe Simon.
I was getting $5 a page for the whole thing, like 5 or 6 panels a page. And one of our little class jokes there was to that in order to make a quick buck, we'd have a big explosion on one page taking up several panels. So we were kind of getting even with the man. We weren't causing much of a problem for them. Maybe they saved $2.
Irwin Hasen.
My page rate at that time was the incredible amount of $8 a page. And we worked our asses off, pardon the expression, day and night. And alone in a room, and these young guys, myself included, got our assignment from the office, went uptown back to our little studio wherever we lived. I lived with my parents, and that was during the Depression, and they needed the money badly. And I really never made enough to help them. But I did. I did what I had to do. And the comic books is such a complicated process. Going to the editor, sitting down with the editor, him telling you what he wants, him telling you, can you suggest a costume? And that's how it was done. It was like in a shirt factory. Piecemeal. Instead of a needle, instead of thread, pen and ink, pen and ink, pen and ink. That's how we lived.
Stanley.
Well, in the beginning, everything was a little bit frantic because we were always working. In fact, all the time, we were working against deadlines. You had to have the book finished in time for the printer because the publisher had arranged with the printer that the presses would be ready for the book at a certain time. And I believe if the book didn't arrive to be printed at that time, the publisher still had to pay for the time. So it was like life or death. That book mustn't be late. So there was always the air of things were frantic in the office, usually. The editor or the publisher or whoever was in charge was always making sure everything was on time. That was almost more important than the quality of the work in those days.
Jerry Robinson.
It was such a new genre, a new medium, that we had no past. You know, there's no traditions. It was living in the present. And so everything was new, so it was very exciting in that sense. And we all were learning from each other.
Jules Pfeiffer.
At the time, I don't think anybody ever intended to stay in comic books. Comic books were a way station towards the world of magazine illustration, which was a big deal then. Saturday Evening Post and Collier's and some of the other magazines were still going on.
Joe Kubert, artist.
The work that most of us did on a freelance basis meant that we kind of worked by ourselves and in a studio if you felt you couldn't work at home or at home. There were shops, we called them shops at the time, where there were groups of people, groups of artists, as I had mentioned before, when I first, the first place I came up to, MLJ, on Canal Street, had about a half dozen artists working up there, lined up on the window overlooking Canal Street. There'd be a lineup of artists and letterers and colorists working all at the same time. But these shops were, I've heard them described as sweatshops. Nothing like it. Nothing like it at all. It was fun. The whole, I mean, these people were into what they were doing. They were happy to be able to do this kind of work. And get money for it at the same time. Nobody chained you to a table. Nobody beat you with a whip in order to do the work. And for me especially at that time, I was just a kid and I was kind of separated from the other adults because of the age difference. It was a place at the time that I loved being in the business, exciting for me. I loved every minute of it.
Every American Boy is My Nephew, The March to War. The rise of the comic book superhero occurred in close synchronicity to America's march to war, or more accurately, the delicate dance of diplomacy required by the Roosevelt administration. When the character of Superman first hit the newsstands in the spring of 1938, Hitler's forces had just pushed into Austria and swallowed up its native government. When Batman first appeared in 1939, Germany and Italy had just announced their Pact of Steel, the beginning of the Axis powers. When Captain Marvel Shazammed into view as 1940 began, World War II was already 3 months old, and Germany had just unveiled its plans to conquer Scandinavia. But if our heroes were physically ready to stand up against the threat from the Third Reich, they were constrained by the impulses of the American people, who were officially neutral, and by appearances in polls and opinion papers in early 1940, intended to remain so. In Hollywood, The challenge of presenting opposition to Hitler and the Nazis by use of a popular art form presented a real dilemma. Almost all of the studio chiefs were Jewish and would have had little sympathy for isolationism, but they were also affected by economics. Initially concerned about foreign box office, in the late 1930s nearly 40% of their income came from overseas, studio chiefs were cautious about insulting the governments of any country that had the power to restrict their product. But as the 1940s began, and Hitler marched into various European countries, and as Italy and Japan formed the Axis powers, more and more doors were being closed to Hollywood product anyway. England was practically the only European market left. Despite the official stance of neutrality, Hollywood began to offer more products to American audiences that dealt with the widening European conflict. Newsreels were obviously incredibly popular in the early 1940s, as audiences avidly devoured any news from the continent. As Hollywood geared itself up to support America and American values, it cautiously towed an increasingly shifting line. The scourge of Nazism appeared in narratives that buried the political implications under genre categories, such as the espionage picture Confessions of a Nazi Spy from 1939 and The Mortal Storm from 1940, which was pitched as a family drama. The comic book industry, churning out its own voluminous product on the East Coast, was a much more renegade business. Publishers had very little collaboration or cooperation amongst each other, let alone any kind of self-imposed regulation. The pace of producing comic books was such that anything was likely to get into print, whether or not it tipped the industry's hand about the war in Europe. In January of 1940, MLJ's Pep Comics featured a brand new superhero, the Shield, a symbol of Americanism and all America stands for, truth, justice, patriotism, courage. The Shield was Joel Higgins, a young man whose scientist's father was developing a secret serum to help the U.S. government. When his father was murdered by Nazis, Joel avenged him by using the serum himself to transform into the strength-enhanced Shield. The Shield, conspicuous in his Stars and Stripes crime-fighting garb, worked for the FBI as his day job, where his identity was known only to J. Edgar Hoover. A month after the Shield's debut appearance, Superman was drawn incidentally into the European conflict. Look magazine commissioned a two-page spread from Siegel and Schuster for its February 1940 issue, asking them to imagine how Superman would handle Hitler and Stalin. In a vignette inspired by the second Superman story in 1938, where two enemy generals are forced by Superman to duke it out, the Man of Steel pummels a Nazi bomb squadron, grabs Hitler by the collar. "I'd like to land a strictly non-Aryan sock on your jaw," he proclaims, providing ammunition to the Superman is really Jewish lobby, and tosses the Fuhrer and Stalin before the judgment of the world court. Since Siegel and Schuster were working on the Superman comic strip out of their Cleveland shop, they ostensibly created this piece outside of DC Comics' jurisdiction. Although Superman nominally worked for Uncle Sam, or at least with his tacit approval, that great super patriot made his own bold appearance in the comic book pages, created by Will Eisner for Quality's National Comics in July 1940, just as the Battle of Britain was going through its worst days. "The forces of greed, evil, intolerance, and crime threaten the very existence out of which America's greatest character is born. Uncle Sam." "Whose uncle are you?" asks an orphan boy, to which Uncle Sam, rendered as a steroidal version of James Montgomery Flagg's 1917 icon, responds, "Everyone's uncle. Every American boy is my nephew." By fall 1940, the real Uncle Sam, or, that is to say, his representative in the form of President Roosevelt, was still unwilling to show his hand. As the president told the Herald Tribune in October, "The fact is that the United States of America, as I have said before, is neutral and does not intend to get involved in war. That we can be neutral in thought, as well as in act, is impossible of fulfillment, because again the people of this country, thinking things through calmly and without prejudice, have been and are making up their minds about the relative merits of current events on other continents. The quest for a supremely patriotic character, untrammeled by diplomatic considerations, began at the McGraw-Hill building on West 42nd Street in New York City. There, publisher Martin Goodman was creating a hothouse for compelling new heroes. Goodman was famous for shifting around the actual titles of his publishing companies as a kind of financial three-card Monty. But Marvel Comics No. 1 in 1939 had been the launching pad for two seminal comic book characters, the Human Torch and Prince Namor, the Submariner. Both had become popular within a year after their debuts, but it was the Torch who first caught fire, as it were, and given his own comic book in October of 1940. They were idiosyncratic characters, inextricably wrapped up in each other's mythology and adventures. The Torch, created by Carl Burgos, was an android, an artificial being, who could burst into flame, although he had a thoroughly unnecessary day job as Jim Hammond, a New York City cop. And if he was rendered somewhat indistinctly as a sputtering red blob, it didn't singe his popularity. Prince Namor, on the other hand, had no end of compelling facial expressions. Drawn with whiplash eyebrows and pointy ears by his creator Bill Everett, the Submariner could usually be found sneering at surface dwellers or superciliously condemning them to their doom. The child of a human father and a princess of an underwater kingdom, eventually revealed as Atlantis, the Submariner sought revenge against the human community for wrongs done to his aquatic brethren. Acknowledged to be comic book's first anti-hero, as well as its first flying character, due to a pair of wings, Mercury-like, on each ankle, Namor could also be rather a bore, ginning up his ancient grudge in comic book after comic book. Finally, someone on Goodman's staff realized that the Human Torch and the Submariner would get along like, well, you know, and soon had them squaring off against each other in two consecutive episodes in the pages of Marvel Mystery Comics in summer 1940. It would become famous as the first crossover storyline in comic book history. These matchups, or smackdowns, became increasingly popular, culminating in one apocalyptic storyline at the end of 1940, in which Namor threatened to deluge the island of Manhattan with one enormous, lethal tidal wave. Whether young readers saw this as a metaphor for an imperious madman who wished to destroy the foundations of democracy is open to conjecture. By spring of 1941, Goodman had hired a comparatively old hand in the business, the 26-year-old Joe Simon, to be his editor. Although there were other costume crime fighters at Marvel Timely, including a mystical creature called the Vision, they were nothing to write home about. Perhaps Goodman and Simon realized that, even though the Torch and the Submariner were the leading players in their studio, combined, they were only one quarter human. Perhaps it was time for a more relatable hero, a regular guy who could openly stand up for America. The time was certainly right. Roosevelt had just won his unprecedented 1940 campaign handily. He was also forcibly moving the country into supporting its one free ally left standing, the British government, by drafting the Lend-Lease Act, which allowed the English forces to supply themselves with American armaments. Perhaps it was the realization that America had just lost one of its previously unassailable heroes. Charles Lindbergh had just testified before Congress and recommended that the United States should come to an agreement with Hitler. Artist Jack Kirby was born Jacob Kurtzberg on Suffolk Street in New York's Lower East Side. He attended the School of Hard Knocks, often reading adventure novels under the dark of the stairs because in his neighborhood, kids who read books for fun got beaten up. Eventually leaving high school before graduation to become an artist, Kirby worked on various comic books, strips, and animation shorts. When he brought his portfolio to Joe Simon, then at Fox Comics, the older editor was impressed by the work and brought Kirby along to work on Blue Bolt, a Flash Gordon-esque superhero. The fact that both men had fathers in the pants business provided a sentimental bond that went a long way toward making some of their early projects bearable. For Simon, Kirby was the natural collaborator for a new super-patriotic character, so he brought Kirby over to Marvel to create Captain America with him. When they brought the character to Goodman, he supposedly loved it, but his only concern was that Hitler might be killed before the first issue hit the stands. With the debut of Captain America number one, where Captain America's punch to Hitler's jaw might have indeed killed him, there was no question about American commitment to defending Europe against the Nazis, at least in the comic book world. The timing was perfect for a character to stand up to the Third Reich. Jews in Germany had been relieved of their economic and civil rights since November of 1938. No matter how secret Hitler's subsequent plans were, American Jews, many of whom still had families in Europe, still knew his tyranny had to be opposed. As Michael Chabon puts it, a lot of those people in the comic book industry are Jews, American Jews, who are a little more clued in about what's happening over there, and a little more worried about it. They have a greater sense of urgency, maybe, than the country at large. Although the majority of the American populace was still against military intervention in Europe as late as November 1941, Captain America opened the floodgates for patriotic characters. Soon, he had to face a different kind of competition, from his own side. Friendly fire in the comic book world came from a battalion of characters. Minuteman, USA, the Patriot, the American Eagle, Fighting Yank, Yankee Doodle Jones, Spirit of 76, the Unknown Soldier, Major Liberty, Liberty Bell, and Miss America. Goodman was forced to put the following squib at the back of the Captain America comics. Imitators, beware. Now that Captain America has attained such a vast following, many comic books are attempting to copy his costume and his deeds. The publishers of Captain America hereby serve notice that they will prosecute to the full extent of the law any and all acts of infringement. There is only one Captain America. Such legal action never came to pass. It was the comic book equivalent of saber rattling. It would have been, well, un-American in any case. When Japan attacked American naval forces at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, the red, yellow, blue, and green gloves finally came off. With America officially at war, all of the superheroes waded into the front lines. "Okay, Axis, here we come," was the war cry among the superheroes. Cooperation was the order of the day. Captain America. Captain America pulled no punches, certainly not on the cover of his eponymous first issue, where he lands a stunning haymaker smack on the jaw of Adolf Hitler. It was an iconic image, the punch that launched a thousand storylines. In March of 1941, President Franklin D. Roosevelt presented a real-life dilemma to the American people via one of his famous fireside chats on the radio. "My fellow Americans and all of the Americas, the pressing problems that confront us are military and naval problems. What we face is cold, hard fact. The first and fundamental fact is that what started as a European war has developed, as the Nazis always intended it should develop, into a world war for world domination." That same month, in the comic book fantasy of America, President Roosevelt was presented with a pressing problem. "But I tell you, Mr. President, there's no stopping these vermin. They're so firmly entrenched in our ranks that I hesitate to give a confidential report to even my most trusted aide. An army spotted with spies, it's useless. What would you suggest, gentlemen? A character out of the comic books? Perhaps a human torch in the army would solve our problem." Actually, it was a comic book character who came to the rescue. More specifically, it was a scrawny recruit named Steve Rogers, part of a government experiment overseen, presumably, by the FBI. Rogers is injected with a secret serum, wielded by a scientist with a more than passing resemblance to Albert Einstein. "It is working," crows the scientist. "There's power surging through these growing muscles. Millions of cells forming at incredible speed." This gimmick actually had been lifted from a Blue Bolt comic that co-creators Joe Simon and Jack Kirby had done for Fox the year before. As Simon remembered, "You know, if it's a good idea, and if it's funny or thrilling, it's okay to do it at least 8 times." The government experiment goes awry when a concealed Nazi agent assassinates the scientist. But within moments, the muscle-bound powerhouse that used to be Steve Rogers leaps to action and exacts revenge. We shall call you Captain America, son, because like you, America shall gain the strength and will to safeguard our shores. Soon, Cap, as legions of fans would refer to him, is placed among the trainees at the fictitious Camp Lehigh as a private. There, the gold-bricking Rogers leads a miserable Clark Kent-like existence. His secret identity is immediately stumbled upon by the camp's teenaged mascot, young Bucky Barnes, who in short order dons a domino mask and becomes Cap's teenaged sidekick. When pitching the character to publisher Martin Goodman, Simon wrote, "I think he should have a kid buddy or he'll be talking to himself all the time." Captain America's appeal was immediate. According to Simon, his debut issue sold at an unheard-of 95% rate, and subsequent issues were soon selling 1 million copies per month. Part of the appeal was his costume, an elegant redistribution of the American flag with a chainmail torso. He had buccaneer boots and gloves, which gave him a jaunty look, and a proud A on his forehead. Much later, in a 21st century adventure, an alien mocks Captain America's courage, to which he retorts sneeringly, "What do you think this A stands for? France?" Originally, he was given a shield that looked like something out of a Prince Valiant comic, but when the publishers of the shield character objected, flexing their litigious muscles, Simon and Kirby were forced to make a switch. They gave Cap a circular shield, a bullseye that made him a moving target. It proved to be a felicitous move, as it made Cap more fluid, although he wouldn't toss his shield like a discus for many, many issues. If ever a comic book character were created out of the zeitgeist, it was Captain America. In a 1988 interview, Jack Kirby said, "There wasn't a day passed by when in the newspaper the war in Europe wasn't mentioned. Hitler wasn't mentioned, Liberty wasn't mentioned, and America wasn't mentioned. Everyone was patriotic. It was ridiculous not to do Captain America, because there was an idea that would be bought by everybody." Joe Simon remembered, "People used to wonder what we were thinking. Did our Jewish ethnicity have anything to do with it, you know, attacking Adolf Hitler and the German military? We never even thought of it. We were just trying to sell comic books. Hitler was the live villain of the time, and Captain America was simply a foil for the comic Hitler. Oh, but it turned out the other way around." The adventures of Captain America and Bucky were repetitively bizarre and bizarrely repetitive. Somehow, Cap and Bucky would leap over a fence at Camp Lehigh and emerge hundreds of miles elsewhere to fight a barrage of drooling, slobbering fiends, werewolves, zombies, deranged hunchbacks, mummies, and other grotesque malefactors, usually some sort of saboteur in disguise. Whoever ran the Fangs concession over at Marvel Timely Comics made out like a bandit. In the second issue of Captain America, Cap and Bucky get into drag, with Cap as a grandma and Bucky as her Fauntleroy grandson, and fly to Germany, where they give Hitler and the German High Command a thorough kick in the pants. Inevitably, they would make it back to Camp Lehigh just in time for roll call, where the sergeant-at-arms would bawl them out, as if they had escaped, not from Hitler's clutches, but from the latest Abbott and Costello Buck Privates flick. What made these escapades unique, however, was the contribution of Simon and Kirby, particularly Kirby, for the first year or so of Cap's existence. As Jules Pfeiffer observed, what Simon and Kirby did in Captain America was blow up the page. They were the first guys to use steroidal-muscled characters before they had steroids, bursting with muscles, but also bursting with action, jumping out of the panel, leaping, falling, flying figures here and flying figures there. And if you liked action, and most kids do, that was something that you paid attention to. For Kirby, it was pure common sense, a way to exploit the possibilities of the comic book page. No other strips really moved. I created the follow-up action, which none of the strips had. In another strip, there would be one action in one panel, and then unrelated action in another panel, whereas I would have a continuous slugfight. If a guy parried, he would follow up with a thrust, so it gave the strip a little motion. My instincts told me that a figure had to be extreme to have power. Simon had nothing but praise for his colleague. "I think that Kirby was quite outstanding," he said. "He had a style that really changed the whole industry. Kirby had what we call a heavy brush. That means he had a lot of ink on it." From the start, Simon and Kirby sought to make a direct connection with their younger readers, initiating the Sentinels of Liberty Club. 10 cents would buy you a tin badge and a membership. Cap and Bucky encouraged youngsters to be part of the larger national struggle, and when the war came along, the Sentinels of Liberty were more explicitly asked, "If you see anything suspicious, even in your own family, report it to the FBI or to the cop on the corner." It was an early example of the "If you see something, say something" public awareness campaign, and it made the Sentinels the most popular affiliation with kids after the Captain Marvel Club. Simon and Kirby were none too popular with grassroots isolationist organizations, such as the America First Party and the German-American Bund. Angered by Timely's hero taking such obvious sides against the Nazis, they tried to use their bullying tactics on Captain America's creators by harassing them outside the Timely headquarters in the McGraw-Hill building. Mayor LaGuardia offered police support, but Simon demurred. "We didn't think that we were insulting anybody, but if we did, so much the better." By the time Captain America's April 1942 issue came out, it didn't matter very much. America was officially at war, and Cap proved it by smashing Japan military commander Tojo in the jaw, much as he had Hitler a year earlier. "You started it, now we'll finish it," he exclaimed on the cover. The war kept Captain America's adventures in an ever more predictable bubble. He never really evolved, and readers never learned more about Steve Rogers or Cap's beliefs and fears. After the war, Bucky was briefly substituted with a sidekick named Golden Girl. By 1949, Cap's raison d'etre was so diminished that he was folded into a horror comic before disappearing completely. He would have a brief revival for a few issues in 1955, fighting communist spies instead of Nazi saboteurs, but the magic was gone. His glory days were during the home front fervor of the early 1940s. However hackneyed his comic book adventures were, he bestrode them like a patriotic colossus. To many young Americans who had a brother or an uncle, or even a father fighting on the front in Europe or in the South Pacific, Captain America was a connection to that conflict, a way of filtering grown-up warfare through the simplicity of a child's eyes. It was a great gift to the home front. Superman may have been a metaphor for America, but Cap simply was America. "I always saw him as a modern-day Uncle Sam," remembers Joe Simon. "That's the only way I can describe him. The real Captain America, during my whole lifetime, my whole experience with him, was the kind of a guy, the kind of American, that should be your friend, or your son, or your father. More of a symbol than anything else." Chapter 3. Okay, Axis, here we come. Comic books at war. With America's declaration of war against Japan on December 8, 1941, nearly all of the superheroes waded into the front lines. In the atmosphere of home front morale, they could now throw themselves at the Japanese. It was a comic book war on two fronts. As Michael Chabon puts it, right at the moment when they most needed it, comic book superheroes were provided with the ultimate supervillain, someone who is much more worthy of their powers than some guy who's trying to rob a bank. World War II cemented and solidified the idea of the comic book superhero. The scale of the battles fought in comic books was near apocalyptic. Tights-clad adventurers could single-handedly defeat an entire panzer division. Prince Namor was easily convinced to rain terror and vengeance on Nazis and the Japanese troops rather than just humanity at large. The Human Torch could be found burning off the arm of an errant German madman who had his hand on some doomsday switch. With their fair-minded ethics untrammeled, the superheroes burst forth with the full extent of their powers. And if it looked like fun, well, that was okay too. The only superhero who seemed less than enthusiastic about his wartime opportunities was Superman. Given his invulnerable confidence, Superman had always been a difficult character to put credibly in harm's way, and America's plunge into international conflict complicated matters. He could have easily ended the war in one day, if he wanted to, but that would have been hard to explain to the millions of kids who would have had to confront the next day's headlines. The solution to Superman's predicament actually appeared in the daily newspaper strip version in 1942. Clark Kent shows up at an Army recruiting center, assuming he'll breeze through the physical exam. Alas, in his preoccupied state to enter the war, Kent slash Superman's X-ray vision inadvertently kicks in as he attempts to read the eye chart on the wall, and by accident, he reads the chart in the adjoining room instead. Rejected as 4F, he muses, "Can you beat it? Here I've got the most powerful body the world has ever known, and through a sad trick of fate, the Army turns me down as hopeless." In his comic books, Superman resolved to serve the American war effort by policing America's home front, declaring, "The United States Army, Navy, and Marines are capable of smashing their foes without the aid of a Superman." Batman also took a back seat in his Batmobile to the war in Europe, holding down the fort in Gotham City instead. No matter. Superman, Batman, and Robin were enlisted as buoyant morale boosters, giving over cover space to shill war bonds, stand shoulder to shoulder with various members of the armed forces, and promote self-sacrifice at home. One thing the DC Comics torchbearers did not have to sacrifice, however, was a 64-page allotment of their adventures. Although wartime rationing suctioned up 30% of the nation's pulp paper supply for the war effort, Harry Donenfeld, using DC's superior sales and contacts, managed to keep churning out comic books when many of his competitors found themselves wanting for the paper on which to print them. If Superman never made it to the European front, his exploits certainly did. Superhero comic books were now more popular than ever. One out of every four magazines shipped to troops overseas was a comic book. Every month, 35,000 copies of Superman were earmarked for servicemen. Apparently, there were several dumbed-down issues of Superman with simpler vocabulary available at induction centers. At PXs in Europe and the South Pacific, comic books were outselling publications such as Reader's Digest and Saturday Evening Post by 10-1. Despite wartime restrictions on paper, by December 1943, monthly comic book sales had climbed to 25 million copies, with retail sales of nearly $30 million. During World War II, market research showed that 70 million Americans, about half the total population, were reading comic books. While the Marvel Timely characters bravely stormed Hitler's Fortress of Evil, some of their creators did as well. At the very least, they were either drafted or enlisted. Joe Simon served for the Coast Guard, and Jack Kirby fought on the European front. Jack went into the war already a very compassionate man, with a lot of violent thoughts in the appropriate places. But when he came out, those thoughts were much more intense, and he knew how to use them in his work, said Mark Evanier, Kirby's biographer. The overworked Captain Marvel writer, Otto Binder, said, "I think I'll be glad when I'm drafted and can get a rest." Sometimes, the comic book creator's skills gave them an entree into special government work. Jerry Siegel worked on various service publications stateside, while Will Eisner created magazines, service manuals, and posters as a chief warrant officer in Washington from 1942 to 1945. Stan Lee, who got his start at Marvel Timely while still the teenaged cousin-in-law of Martin Goodman, found himself being trained to cut down enemy transmission wires on the front lines. When his superiors discovered that the 20-year-old Stan Lee had a gift for writing, he was assigned to pen scripts for training films instead of shipping out with the infantry. He even managed some freelance work from his barracks. Timely would occasionally send me a request. Can you do a 10-page story of this character or that, and let us have it by Tuesday? So at night, when everybody was sleeping, I'd bang out a story, and I'd send it back to them. Cooperation and team spirit were preached on the home front, as millions of Americans put aside their petty differences and marched together, shoulder to shoulder, ready to make sacrifices for the greater good. The stage was set for such comradeship in the winter of 1940, when the Justice Society of America convened for the first time in the pages of All-Star Comics No. 3. The origins of the Justice Society of America lie partly in the spirit of comradeship, partly in the spirit of commerce. In 1938, Detective Comics had essentially given a franchise to M.C. Gaines to develop his own line of comic books under the All-American banner. The heroes created there, often by Sheldon Moldoff, were admired but not nearly as successful as Superman and Batman, and none of them had his own book. Gaines' suggestion was to join all of the second bananas in one bunch, thereby creating the first superhero team. The Justice Society was composed of the Flash, comics' preeminent super speedster, Hawkman, a high-flying crusader abetted by an anti-gravity nth metal, the sorcerer Dr. Fate, the emerald ring-wielding Green Lantern, the chemically enhanced Hourman, the Sandman, he of the somnolent gas gun, the pint-sized Adam, and the Spectre, a sepulchral figure with powers from beyond the grave. In their first call to order, the JSA met to recount their most exciting stories at the behest of Johnny Thunder, a plainclothes youngster with a magic genie, who was probably comics' first official pest. For the next 36 issues, the JSA would meet in the first few pages, acknowledge some dire threat, and then the members would split off into separate adventures, solve the problem, and return for the conclusion in a metaphorical gloved handshake of congratulations. Membership in the Justice Society of America had a peculiar meta quality to it. According to the JSA charter, once you got your own comic book with your name in the title, you had to recuse yourself from active membership. This is why Superman and Batman were naught but honorary members, and why, in 1941, The Flash and Green Lantern had to streak away to parts unknown so that they could shoulder comic magazines of their own. If this lent a slight bargain basement quality to the remaining members, it didn't matter to fans. The idea of a superhero team was irresistible. As writer Jim Harmon put it, bound by similar interests and occupations, how could the masked and more than human crusaders who eventually became the Justice Society of America not become the closest of compatriots? Their conspiracies, their goals, their passions were all the same, and the same as ours, their admirers. The Justice Society highlighted the importance of having all hands on deck. On the real-life home front, no one could be left behind. Everybody counted. The most pronounced change in American society during the war was the introduction of women to the workforce in massive numbers. The female workforce grew by more than 50%, with more than 6 million women taking on new jobs, mostly in the defense industry and in civil service. And if women were taking on traditionally male jobs in real life, why not in comic books too? A year into the Justice Society's existence, All American Comics introduced the character of Wonder Woman, and she quickly joined their ranks. She was initially consigned by Hawkman to be our secretary while we are at war, but that was really because she soon had her own book too. Those superheroes sure knew their JSA charter by heart. Other members eventually came on board to join Wonder Woman, Starman, Dr. Midnight. And after more than 3 years, All American took a gamble and created adventures in which the JSA members fought crime together as an actual team. During the war, the JSA displayed international solidarity with stories of shipping food to ravaged European countries and raising money for war orphans. The character of the Sandman proclaimed, "Yes, we may be of different nationalities and religions, Protestant, Catholic, or Jewish, but together we're all red-blooded, clean, healthy, free Americans. You can't beat that combination, Adolf. It's too strong. Gardner Fox, an inventive writer who created the Justice Society's exploits and sustained them for years, summed up the credo that kept such a disparate group of adventurers together. I believe in the brotherhood of man and peace on earth. If I could do it all with a wave of my hand, I'd stop all this war and the silly nonsense of killing people. So I use the superhero's powers to accomplish what I couldn't do as a person. The superheroes were my wish fulfillment figures for benefiting the world. The popularity of the Justice Society super team was noticed over at Marvel Timely, which quickly put their heavy hitters, Captain America, the Human Torch, and the Submariner, together in the pages of all winners. But here, too, their respective adventures were mostly separate. For only two issues after the war, they were joined by some B-level heroes to become the All-Winners Squad. But when it came to the issue of the wartime enemy, Gardner Fox's notion of the Brotherhood of Man would have hardly been of interest to the characters in the Marvel Timely world, or to any of the other anti-Axis publishers, for that matter. During the war fever, according to comics historian Gerard Jones, you have some appallingly racist portrayals of Japanese, as animals, as demons. The portrayal of Japanese in wartime comics was more appallingly racist than in any other medium, even in the movies, and that's saying something. Somehow, the notion of a non-Caucasian enemy unleashed unprecedented revenge fantasies from a battery of artists and editors ensconced in studios in Manhattan. The Japanese in comics all wore glasses and had buck teeth, or often fangs, and claw-like fingernails, wrote Don Thompson in 1970. Their skins were usually yellow, often greenish-yellow. They were the enemy, so it was all right to derogate them racially. If anyone complained about stereotypical depictions during wartime, those objections went unrecorded. Jules Pfeiffer remembers, "That's what it was in those days, and I was doing it myself." It's important to say that, with all their good points, one of the negative points about comic books was how racist and stereotyped it was in terms of minorities. Jews drew blacks who were cowards and ran from fights. The Japanese were frothing at the mouth. The Germans were blonde hulks who, underneath it all, were terrible cowards. It was a tradition. Still, in the heat of a horrendous battle that had young Americans fighting on two fronts across the world from each other, the comic book heroes sustained our fighting men and women, as well as the folks back home who supported them. Stan Lee observes,
"I think that the troops, the soldiers, loved those comic books. They loved reading about characters like Captain America. And our books, very, very often at Captain America, fighting the Nazis, which I guess it was great for the troops, because we always won in the comic book stories. It's a shame all wars couldn't be done via comic books. We'd always win and nobody would ever be hurt."
Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is one of the most indelible characters of the comic book pantheon. Her creator, William Moulton Marston, was one hell of a character, too. Marston was part self-made promoter, part Harvard-educated psychologist, part mountebank, and an all-American original. Most comic book writers of the Golden Age were either starstruck kids or hacks with few options. Marston actually auditioned for the role at the age of 47. His scientific background consisted of odds and ends, an interest in the relation between blood pressure and conscious duplicity, for example, and a fascination with the erotic implications of domination and submission. Based on the former, he contrived an early version of the polygraph test. Based on the latter, he wrote a series of books and articles promoting the notion that if men willingly submitted their authority to women, it would yield both parties great erotic satisfaction and the world would be a better place. Neither of these two concepts proved financially sufficient to raise a family, perhaps because Marston lived in a menage a trois with two women, but that's another story. So Marston supplemented his income by serving as a consultant to various public relations interests in Hollywood. Casting about for some sort of reputable and lucrative forum, Marston famously gave an interview to Family Circle magazine in October of 1940, where,